rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you. Be seated, everyone. Appreciate it. We welcome you to our second hearing of the day in Twin Falls County for the Idaho Supreme Court today. You will note that Justice Brody has recused herself in this case. And we have District Judge Mitchell Brown in the 6th District serving with us. We welcome him as pro tem justice on this court today. This case is D.L. Evans Bank versus Dean. The appeal is brought on behalf of Henry Dean by Bradley Van de Vries. And the respondent, D.L. Evans Bank, is represented here by Rep. Miller. Counsel, either of you have any preliminary matters for the court for your argument?
Nothing for the appellant, no. No, thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome. Mr. Van de Vries, you may proceed, sir.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices, Justice Pro Tem, Madam Clerk, Counsel. May it please the Court, my name is Brad Van Hendries with Everly Berlin in Boise, and I represent Henry Dean today. This is a statute of limitations case, and I want to talk about, firstly, a few things the parties agree on appeal. First, the parties agree that the statutes applicable to the default judgment entered in a 2009 case are governed by the statutes in effect when that default was judgment was entered, January 13, 2010. The parties agree on that. The parties agree that an order is not a judgment. The parties agree that only one document titled default judgment was ever entered in that 2009 case. And the parties also agree that D11's sole claim in this present lawsuit, the 2020 case, is subject to a 6-year statute of limitations set forth in Idaho Code 5215. Those 4 points are undisputed by the parties on appeal. Why is that important? I think that's important because an order is not a judgment.
Just a point of concern. I realize you're presenting these like stipulated facts, but those really are all points of law, right? I mean, we're not bound to by what the parties stipulate the controlling law to be. Isn't that a question of law for this court? I mean, it's good to know you agree, but...
I think I'd agree with you. Just pointing out that the parties do not dispute those on appeal.
Okay.
But those are points of law. I think I would agree with you. Let's start off with what is an action on a judgment. An action on a judgment is a new lawsuit. It's a lawsuit on the debt represented by a judgment. From the date a judgment is entered, former and applicable here, Idaho Code 5215 gave a party 6 years after the date of judgment is entered to file a new lawsuit, an action on that judgment.
To renew it.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Or to renew the judgment.
A different statute, 10.11.11, allows the party within 5 years from the date that judgment was entered under applicable law to move for renewal of that judgment. And thereafter, a party could obtain a renewed judgment under 10.11.11. There's no dispute that did not happen in this case, in the 2009 case. And I do need to make a distinction. This case concerns collection law, and the parties have provided a host of Idaho collection law. I think it provides context, but this really isn't a collection case. Collection proceedings would be in the 2009 case, the Blaine County case. This is a new lawsuit subject to a new caption, new case number, must be served, subject to all defenses. And the reason an action on the judgment is significant is it's not a renewal. It is a new lawsuit that would result in a new judgment that the judgment creditor could then go forward and collect on that judgment. That's the purpose as outlined in Grazer of an action on a judgment. An action on judgment, according to the court, this court in Grazer, must be brought within 6 years from the date of the judgment. Date of judgment, this is again the Grazer case, means the entry of judgment. That entry of judgment it's not when the district judge signs the document. It's actually when the court clerk puts that file stamp up on the corner. We have case law applying that date for when a document, including a judgment, is entered.
What's the point of renewal then if it doesn't really give you anything?
It can prolong a lien, absolutely. That is the point of a renewal. And that is what Idaho Code 10.11.11, it specifies that you get a new lien right in the title.
But if you can't bring an action on the lien, it could sit there forever.
And be recouped if a party, if you have a new lien, you record it, get your renewed judgment after applying to renew your judgment, and go record that renewed judgment. That lien continues. And you can, in a case where the judgment is entered, the second that judgment is docketed, that judgment becomes a lien on any real property owned by the judgment debtor. The creditor could take that lien to other counties within the state and record that judgment to other counties, record that judgment, and the lien would attach there to property owned by the judgment debtor. Through the renewal process, judgment creditor can continue that lien and take it to which counties it thinks a judgment debtor might own real property. If there's a refinancing, if there's a sale, that judgment creditor could recoup the value of its judgment. But I don't think the court needs to decide this issue in this case. I need to be clear on that. But if the party wanted to affirmatively execute on a judgment, I believe the correct procedure is an action on judgment.
So what does the renewal action renew then? It's not just renewing the lien, is it?
Well, in the Grazer case and other cases, this is really a question of remedies. What is a judgment creditor to do with its judgment? Well, a judgment never goes away. The Grazer case establishes that. But what is a judgment creditor to do with its judgment? You have two remedies. You can execute, affirmatively collect, have the sheriff go look at bank accounts, talk to an employer, garnish wages, or you can have a lien, and you could foreclose on that lien. The judgment, the debt represented by the judgment never goes away, but Idaho Code is quite clear. We have Title 11 executions, which allow 5 years to execute on that judgment under the applicable time frame as applicable to this case. And if you want to renew your judgment, you can get a renewed judgment. When that is entered by the court, you can go record that and continue your lien. But if you want to affirmatively continue to execute after 5 years, the correct procedure is through an action on judgment. And the statutory scheme makes sense. The Title 11, under the applicable time frames, give a judgment creditor 5 years to execute on that judgment. Well, and that's very definitive. There is no extension procedure. There is no reference to a renewed judgment in Title 11. So Idaho law gives the judgment creditor 5 years from the date of judgment to execute. So then the judgment creditor might, say it's a $100,000 judgment, and maybe they collect $50,000 through a bank garnishment. Well, the value of their judgment, the debt represented by that judgment, is still $50,000. But they're bumping up, or they've just passed that 5-year period from the date of the judgment. What is the judgment creditor to do? Idaho law gave that judgment creditor an extra year to evaluate its position, determine what assets the judgment debtor might have, and okay, let's go forward. This is worth it. Let's pursue our $50,000. We have up until 6 years to file a new lawsuit. It's a fairly straightforward lawsuit. Pay, Your Honor, your court, we have $50,000 that we're owed from a case that was determined. We'd like a judgment establishing and awarding us that $50,000. Once that judgment is entered under the new case number in the action on a judgment, the judgment creditor has a brand new judgment. They can go forward and collect for 5 years. The Idaho Code 11-101 and the 5-year limitation period there would not prevent that judgment creditor from moving forward on its execution. That's the scheme that we work in, and that's why Idaho Code 5215, which governs the statute of limitations on an action on a judgment, provides 6 years. It all makes sense when you look at this from a grand scheme of collection law.
So I want to push back on your position that 10.11.11 only does one thing, which is extend the lien. When I look at the version of 10.11.11 that was in effect at the time this judgment was first renewed, it has two sentences. The first sentence, and I will cut out the first part, says the court which entered the judgment, other than a judgment for child support, may upon motion renew such judgment, period. So you can renew a judgment. Then, Sentence 2 says the renewed judgment may be recorded in the same manner as the original judgment, and the lien established thereby shall continue. So sentence 2 continues the lien. So are you arguing that that sentence 1 is not a separate act, renewing the judgment?
I think the response, Justice Song, is the remedy that attaches to that renewal. The judgment would have to be renewed in order to continue the lien. I think that's the procedural step. And that, to be clear, I think that that code section that you just read is abundantly clear. If you want to continue the lien, you must obtain a renewed judgment and go record it. But I think the remedy is the dispositive issue there. You can renew that judgment upon your motion, that the statute is clear, but the very statute that allows for that renewal is entitled Renewal Judgment Lien.
No, it's entitled Renewal of Judgment dash dash lien.
Correct.
It's not saying Renewal of Judgment Lien. It could easily be construed to say Renewal of Judgment and the lien on the Renewal of Judgment. And this is my issue. The first sentence says, renew the judgment. Definition of renew, make new again. So why, under 5215, does your 6 years not begin anew? You've made the judgment new again. You have 6 more years to file an action on the judgment.
I think it has to do from when the statute starts running. And we know that statute starts running from the date of a judgment. It would be a different scenario if we had different facts in this case. Maybe a case will come to this court where there's a renewed judgment entered, and a party argues that renewed judgment extended my 6-year statute of limitations, or now an 11-year statute of limitations for to bring my action on judgment. That's simply not the facts that we have here.
I'm relying on the plain language of 10.11.11. They are different things. The first sentence talks about an order renewing the judgment. The second sentence says if you want a lien, you need to record a renewed judgment. So the fact a renewed judgment wasn't recorded doesn't mean the judgment wasn't renewed. It just means perhaps your lien hasn't continued. That's my struggle. Nothing in that first sentence says it's not renewed unless a renewed judgment is issued.
I think the problem is the date that is on that judgment. If the court which renewed the judgment were to go back in time and say this is the new date of the judgment, maybe record something, and there are maybe procedural workarounds, but there is only one document in the 2009 case that can qualify as a judgment. We know that based on the definitions of Rule 54. We know that from Justice Eisman's case, Cook v. Arias. A judgment is a distinct document. It has much legal significance. It can't contain a record of prior proceedings.
And I understand that, but 10.11.11 says you can renew it through an order.
I don't see any reference to an order in the plain language in that statute. It says you can, upon motion, renew it, but the second sentence says the renewed judgment. I think if a party wanted to argue that its statute of limitations under 5215 had restarted, you would at least need a judgment at that time to argue. Then there would be something to restart that statute of limitations. But we know an order does not start. An order cannot qualify as a judgment. It can. The title is not dispositive. I should clarify that. It's the substance of the document. This order, January 9th, 2015, cannot qualify as a judgment. It contained information in contravention to the requirements of Rule 54 and the case law interpreting that rule. We simply only have one document which can qualify as a judgment, and that file stamp date, January 13th, 2010, is the date the statute of limitations started running in this case. There's nothing else that could have restarted it because there's no other document that could qualify as a judgment in the 2009 case.
And the language of the statute doesn't require, in the first sentence, the issuance of a renewed judgment. It just says, upon motion, renew such judgment. So can you address opposing counsel's contention that the order is enough to renew the original judgment?
I can't see a reason why a judgment creditor would move for renewal of its judgment. And even when it obtains an order that says, upon entry of your renewed judgment, the same can be entered and recorded in the same manner as the original judgment. Judge Elgee in 2015 thought there was a distinction between the original judgment and any renewed judgment. Even this order told D11s to, they needed a renewed judgment.
If they wanted to record it.
And continue its lien. And again, that's one of the problems analyzing this case is looking at the collection procedures applicable to the 2009 case and looking at the defenses, including statute of limitations, on a brand new lawsuit, which is an action on a judgment. There is simply no document which can retroactively go back in time and say the date on that judgment has changed. I'm not sure there's a mechanism where you couldn't do that. Maybe a district court could do that.
When we look at the plain language of a statute, we, of course, have to notice the language that's not there. I'm just wondering if the legislature really intended this to be interpreted the way you're explaining, wouldn't it have been far simpler for them just to say that? And the lien established thereby shall continue, however the statute of limitation will continue to run. I mean, it just seems to me like if the legislature really wanted that kind of an interpretation, the plain language of what they were saying, it would have been just so obvious and easy for them to say it that way rather than creating an unsaid loophole that can be exploited later.
I don't think it's a loophole, and I do think the legislature could have been more precise in this statute. I think the legislature somewhat ignored Title 11 when drafting this statute. I think it certainly ignored an action on a judgment when drafting this statute. But I wouldn't call it a loophole.
Do you have any authority for your interpretation? Have we said what you're suggesting?
The Grazer case and the Bennett case both say very succinctly the statute of limitations begins to run on a date of judgment. 6 years have passed. The judgment creditor is no longer entitled to bring an action on judgment. The statute of limitations expired.
But didn't both of those cases involve foreign judgments that the creditor had failed to renew before bringing them to Idaho?
Correct. However, judgment law in Idaho gives full faith and credit to sister states. We have that from the Lamon case. Bennett and Grazer talk about it a little bit. Specifically in Lamon, if a judgment is revived to full force and effect in another state and brought to Idaho under the EFJA for domestication, Idaho courts will recognize that judgment, even though it might not have qualified under our statutes. And I guess to get back to Justice Stegner, I don't think there is a case in Idaho which purely defines, at least not in modern times, interpreting these statutes, but says there is an action on a judgment. There are 6 years within which you can bring that. We know that the date of the judgment is the accrual date, but we do have a lack of authority on a purely Idaho domestic judgment, and then a judgment creditor seeking an action on a judgment after the 6 year statute of limitations. And I know all we have are foreign judgments being brought here.
That haven't been renewed.
Correct. But again, there is nothing in this renewal statute that says the statute of limitations would restart it. The legislature actually had to go in 2018 and add that language to the statute. In our briefing, we've cited a number of cases on canons of construction and statutory interpretation. When the legislature acts, it acts prospectively. That was not the law in 2015 when this order renewing a judgment was entered. It was not the law in 2010 when the default judgment was entered.
Yeah, but doesn't common human experience suggest to us that often when the legislature acts, it's reacting? In other words, if they become aware that one of their statutes is being misused or misinterpreted, they react and provide greater specificity.
But that would not make that statute retroactive, and all we can go on is the plain language. And even Judge Williamson, in this, in our current case, agreed that 2018 amendment to 10.11.11 is not retroactive.
I agree, but if they are reacting, that means we shouldn't presume that the change meant that they thought it meant something different before, which is what I hear you arguing, that they wouldn't have changed it if they thought it, you know, maybe they thought it was unclear, but certainly that doesn't mean they agree with your interpretation.
I know it's in our briefing. When the legislature amends a statute, it's presumed to have changed the law. And I don't think there's anything in that statute that even tries to make it retroactive where they are trying to fix some alleged abuse of the statute. I'll wrap up briefly with my 30 seconds left, but this is a statute of limitations case. It's very clear the statute started running in January 13, 2010. There's no dispute about that. It's very clear that six-year statute would have expired January 13, 2016. There's no dispute about that. The dispute is whether or not something in the middle restarted that statute of limitations. We submit that a judgment is the only document which could have restarted that six-year statute, and there simply is none other than the January 13, 2010 judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court. Chief Justice, Justices, Justice Pro Tem, Madam Clerk, Counsel. It's an honor to appear before this court and present argument on behalf of the 11th Bank. My name is Rhett Miller. I'm with the firm of Parsons, Loveland, Shirley, and Lindstrom in Burley. The case at hand involves an action on judgment filed in 2020. As has been discussed, an action on judgment is a common law form of judgment renewal, allowing a party to obtain a new judgment based upon a valid prior judgment. Many issues have been raised herein, none of which warrant the reversal of the district court's underlying decisions herein. As the court is aware, the record is voluminous and includes over 1,300 pages and 8 hearing transcripts. I'd like to briefly summarize the facts evidenced by the record. In 2009, retired attorney Randy Stone, a prior partner at my firm, who I think I've met maybe 3 times, filed a complaint in Blaine County against the petitioner herein, Mr. Henry Dean, seeking deficiency judgments following 2 deed of trust sales. Following unsuccessful attempts at personal service of Mr. Dean, Mr. Stone moved to publish notice of the proceeding. The motion to publish was granted by the district court. Notice by publication was effectuated, and a copy of the summons and complaint were sent via certified mail to Mr. Dean. A return receipt evidencing delivery of such document was then returned to Mr. Stone. Such publication and mailing were reasonably calculated to afford Mr. Dean notice of the pending action. Following such mailing, Mr. Stone received a letter from Mr. Dean discussing the nature of the lawsuit, including the nature of the claims, the parties, and the damages sought. Mr. Dean asked for dismissal of such claims. Such letter evidences Mr. Dean had actual notice of the pending lawsuit prior to entry of the default judgment. About a month later, no appearance had been entered by Mr. Dean, nor a responsive pleading filed. At that point, Mr. Stone requested and was granted a default judgment against Mr. Dean and other entities in an amount over $1 million. That judgment was then renewed by motion and order in January of 2015 and September of 2019. At no point during such time did Mr. Dean appear in the 2009 case. In fact, I don't believe he's appeared in that case even today. In early 2020, a former partner at my office, Jason Nace, filed a complaint initiating this case. He made just one claim, the action on judgment. The arguments of the parties on appeal have been presented in 130 pages of briefing. As is evidenced by such briefing, both Mr. Dean and Dale Evans Bank concur on the majority of the applicable cases governing the issues presented herein. Nevertheless, the parties' interpretation of such case law and analysis of its implications to the questions raised herein varies greatly. Mr. Dean raises 6 issues on appeal. Did the district court err in failing to dismiss the complaint? Did the district court err as a matter of law in granting DL Evans' motion for partial summary judgment? In that motion, the 11s asked for a determination that it was entitled to a judgment, but not a specific damage amount. The next question presented, did the district court err in finding out there was no material, in finding that there was no material fact in dispute that would preclude summary judgment in favor of D11s? Did the district court err in denying Dean's motion for reconsideration of the prior orders? Did the district court err in denying the 60B4 motion to set aside the judgment? And is Dean entitled to an award of attorney's fees and costs? Essentially, Mr. Dean challenges every substantive decision of the district court, which include rulings on the following issues raised. Other issues may have been raised, but do not appear to be challenged herein. First, from the motion to dismiss and judgment on the pleading, it was therein that Mr. Dean argued that the court lacked jurisdiction. Next, Mr. Dean's second motion to dismiss, in which he argued the court lacks jurisdiction, and D11's bank failed to state a claim based upon the six-year limitation that's been discussed already. Next, there was Mr. Dean's motion for summary judgment, in which he argued a renewed judgment cannot be executed upon, that the plaintiff's right to an action on judgment expired in January of 2016, that amendments to renewal statutes are not retroactive, and again, that the court lacks jurisdiction over Mr. Dean. Next, there was D11's motion for partial summary judgment in which it sought to establish liability, or that it was in fact entitled to a judgment. Therein, D11's argued that an order renewing a judgment renews a judgment, that an action on judgment is not dependent on right to execute. D11's also sought a holding that it was entitled to a judgment, as I mentioned. We then had the motion for reconsideration, in which Mr. Dean argued that a statute of limitations for action on judgment began at the entry of a default, as we've heard today, that there is no reviver under Idaho law, that a renewed judgment cannot be executed on, that an order is not a judgment, that the judgment was not renewed, and again, that the district court lacked jurisdiction over Mr. Dean.
So, counsel, let's jump to the issue that we discussed with Mr. Van Der Vries. His position is you don't have a judgment, whether it's a title judgment or renewed judgment, with a new file stamp, it's not a renewed judgment. Can you address that argument?
Certainly. I think the questions there that must be decided by the court are, were the renewal orders effective? And second, did the renewal orders restart the time period for an action on judgment? And I think that's maybe a different way to frame those questions. The court must determine if the orders renewing the judgment in 2015 and 2019 did in fact renew the default judgment without entry of a standalone judgment titled renewed judgment. This is perhaps the issue with the least precedent or binding guidance before the court today. Essentially, Dean argues that under the 1995 statute, a new judgment must be entered with every renewal order, and that such order is not in itself effective in renewing the judgment. The 11th has argued that the order does exactly what it states and renews the judgment, thereby beginning such judgment anew and restarting all of those timelines. D11's position is supported by this court's recent decision in the case of Alpha Mortgage v. Drinker. In that case, this court stated, the district court entered the original judgment on February 23, 2010, the same year as the default judgment here. The original judgment was renewed on February 12, 2015, the same year as the first order renewing judgment herein. Alpha's mortgage to renew was filed on February 10, 2020, just months after D11's second motion to renew judgment was filed in late 2019. The court then said less than 5 years after the 2015 judgment was last renewed. Consequently, the district court did not err when it granted Alpha's motion to renew the original judgment. Now, it appears that what the court relied upon in support of the fact that the original judgment was renewed in 2015 is an order renewing the judgment and not a standalone document titled Renewed Judgment in Alpha. Nevertheless, for the court's information, the 2020 renewal in Alpha was accompanied by a renewed judgment. There was an objection to the order, and rather than go and fight that out, it appears that they simply provided a renewed judgment that was signed by the court, and the objection was then withdrawn, is my understanding.
And as I recall Alpha, there was no argument raised in Alpha similar to what Mr. Van Der Vries is raising here, that without a new document titled judgment with a new file stamp, it wasn't renewed. Instead, I recall the issue in Alpha was the argument that if you didn't record the new judgment and continue your lien, you couldn't renew the judgment after 5 years. And so are the issues between Alpha in this case slightly different in that regard?
I think they are different. I think it still shows that just as the judgment in Alpha was deemed a judgment, even though there was a renewal order, that I think that's where the similarity is here, that we have orders renewing judgment and that is the basis for there being a judgment hearing.
But the ability to renew a judgment is separate from whether that renewed judgment can be recorded and constitute a lien.
No, that's correct, yes. I think this has been discussed, but this appears to be in line with the 1995 version of 10.11.11, which states that the court may, upon motion, renew such judgment, period. A motion is granted or denied by an order. An order was obtained by Dale Evans in this case, renewing the judgment twice.
Well, you can file a motion for entry of judgment, right? And a judgment can be entered in response to that.
Certainly, and I think I've done that as well. I would note there are times when the rules state an application for a judgment rather than a motion. I don't know if there's a lot of law saying that there's a real distinction between a motion and an application, but I think when talking about like an application for default judgment, that's how the rules phrase that, not a motion. The district court agreed with this analysis in its memorandum decision, holding that the law does not require a separate judgment following an order renewing judgment. The court cited Alpha Mortgage in support of this proposition, which case relied upon the same 1995 version of the renewal statute at issue here. This holding is additionally supported by the case law summarized and cited in the 11th briefing, which shows that recent changes to the renewal statute simply codified and clarified existing law within the statute. I think further on that question, if the judgment's renewed, we must determine if the renewal order restarted the time period for an action on judgment. I think that's
before we leave the 2018 amendment, I'd like you to respond to the argument that the opposing counsel has made that the additional language added in 2018 to 10.11.11 wasn't a clarification of what the law was, but it was a change of law. He made the statement that any time a statute is changed, then we should presume that the law has changed. Is that correct?
I don't believe that's correct. I think we still have to look back to the case law to determine what the law was prior to that change. The change itself does not imply what the law was before. It simply says, from here forward, this is what it is. So to see what it was before that date, we need to look back to the cases and the law before that date. In this case, I think that's the Lehman case, which I believe late 1800s or early 1900s says an action on judgment. A renewal or a reviver restarts the time period for an action on judgment.
Do we know from Lehman whether the reviver resulted in a document titled judgment with a new stamp, or whether the reviver just resulted in an order saying that judgment is renewed?
That's a very interesting question that I have not considered. I'm not sure on that. I know that some of the cases I think may use the phrase order of reviver. I know I've seen that language in the past few days, but I can't recall where. In its second motion to dismiss, the district court analyzed the impact of renewal orders on the statute of limitations for an action on judgment under Idaho Code 5215. Under the 1995 version of the renewal statute, it reasoned that similar to the holding in the case of Lehman, our statute would begin to run against the judgment or order of reviver from its date. And there it is. The Lehman case says our statute would begin to run against the judgment or order of reviver from its date. Therefore, the court held that it agreed with D11's position that the statute of limitations for an action on judgment begins to run on the date of the renewed judgment. This issue was again analyzed in the memorandum decision. The court reiterated that renewal is a form of revival of judgment, similar to Lehman. It then looked to the case of Grazer to determine that the statute of limitations, limitation periods, relating to judgments runs from the date the judgment is entered or last renewed in the rendering state. In this case, that state would be Idaho. The court then looked to Smith v. Smith and again Grazer for the proposition that both renewal by motion and action on judgment are valid cumulative means of renewing an Idaho judgment. Next, the court looked to the case of Bennett v. Bank of Eastern Oregon, in which an action on judgment claim failed as 6 years had passed since the date of the original action without subsequent renewal. The court distinguished that case from Bennett as two renewal orders had been entered in this case, or in the 2009 case, I should say, thereby restarting the statute of limitations for an action on judgment as held by Lehman. Again, I believe this analysis is well supported by the case law referenced in those underlying decisions and summarized by Gail Evans in its briefing herein. I'd like to address a couple of the other issues on appeal, unless there's any other questions on those. The first would be what I think is a threshold question here, and that is, did the court possess personal jurisdiction over Dean? In its order on motion to dismiss and motion for judgment on the pleadings, the district court determined it held personal jurisdiction over Mr. Dean because the complaint alleges facts that give rise to the court's personal jurisdiction over Dean. Based upon the fact that the 2009 judgment is an Idaho judgment against Dean, and that the facts underlying that judgment arise from Dean's business transactions in Idaho. The court further found that Dean voluntarily submitted to the court's personal jurisdiction. The court reasoned that Dean's appearance, while stating this appearance, is without waiver of any defenses, including, but not limited to, insufficient service of process and lack of personal jurisdiction, constituted an appearance that equated to service of process upon the party, similar to the case of Engelman. For me, this decision was unsurprising, as the initial appearance did not meet any of the requirements of a special appearance under Rule 4.1b7. These are a little bit, perhaps technical, but I think they're supported by some substance as well that I'll get to, including the title special appearance, followed by a Rule 12b2, 4, or 5 motion within 14 days, or within such time, later time, as the court permits. The record is clear that the court never altered this 14-day timeline. Mr. Dean argues that an email from myself allowing additional time to respond altered this rule. This is contrary to the plain language of the rule, requiring permission of the court for this specific extension. Dean Evans complied with what it agreed to in that email, as it did not seek default during the period of that extension. 20 days later, Dean filed his first motion to dismiss and motion for judgment on the pleadings, arguing under 12b-2, 12b-6, 12b-8, and 12c, far beyond the 12b-2, 4, and 5 motions permitted under a special appearance. As such, the court's analysis was correct. In addition to being subject to this court's jurisdiction based on the nature of the claims herein, Mr. Dean consented to the court's jurisdiction. In its order on a second motion to dismiss, the district court relied upon its reasoning from the first order regarding personal jurisdiction. Next, it got a little bit different. In its next order, which granted the 11's motion for partial summary judgment and denied Dean's motion for summary judgment, the district court again addressed personal jurisdiction. The court backtracked just a little bit in that order and said, no, just because this is what it called in the first order, I think, was a continuation of the 2009 case. It said, no, it's not that. This is a separate and distinct case. So the court came back just a little bit from that. The court clarified that the 2020 action was a new and separate action. Nevertheless, it incorporated the majority of its earlier analysis. It then went on to analyze Rule 8A1, which requires a short and plain statement of the grounds of the court's jurisdiction, ultimately determining that D11's allegation of venue, coupled with the history of the original case outlined in the complaint for the action on judgment, constituted substantial compliance with Rule 8. Ultimately, the court again concluded that being submitted to the jurisdiction of the court, the court's analysis correctly applied the applicable rules of civil procedure. The one other, are there any questions on the personal jurisdiction?
There's no.
The other issue that I see as a main threshold issue here is whether or not the default judgment is void on its face. In the order on motions, the district court analyzed whether the default judgment from the 2009 case was void on its face. The court noted that a collateral attack seeking to void a judgment can only happen where the judgment is void on its face. It cited the case of Whale v. Deppenbach for that proposition. Ultimately, the district court reasoned that even if Dean's assertions that D.L. Evans attempted to serve him at an old address were true, after which publication was made, that was simply not enough to show that a judgment was void. Alternatively, the district court reasoned that even if a collateral attack were allowed, the attack would be untimely. It cited the portions of the record which indicate that Mr. Dean had been apprised of the default judgment over a decade ago, and likely about the case, as I mentioned before with the letter, even before default was entered. Therefore, the court concluded that even if a collateral attack were available to defendant, the motion to set aside the judgment would fail due to untimeliness. Defendant Dean has argued a lack of due process. The record does not support this argument. The district court's analysis aptly applies the applicable law to the facts of the case, holding that the judgment is not void on its face and therefore not subject to collateral attack, and that even if it were, such attack is untimely and must be denied. This case perfectly illustrates why challenges to judgments must be brought in a timely fashion.
But under a 60B4 challenge, hasn't this court held that judgment can be challenged at any time?
I think it can be challenged at any time. If I recall correctly, thinking back to the case law, I believe that there's law indicating that it still has to be timely after you find out about the issue. And I'm sorry, I don't have a citation to that. But that would certainly be my argument today. Once you know about an issue, 10 years is still too long. With that said, additionally, I don't think the record supports that there are any actual issues with the judgment, but that would be my response to that question. The parties involved in the 2009 proceeding have retired and moved on. As such, I think that shows why it's so difficult to challenge a judgment so far down the road. As I mentioned, you know, a prior partner in my office, I've only met him 3 times. It's difficult for people to recall what happened in one of many cases years and years ago. A couple points I'd like to point out in response to the appellant's arguments today. I think the Smith v. Smith case makes very clear that an action on judgment is a form of renewal. I think that's important. An action on judgment is a form of renewal, and the renewal statute allows for renewal. They both provide renewal.
Well, and I don't think he's contesting that. I think he's saying without a document titled judgment with a new filing stamp or titled renewed judgment, your time doesn't start again under 5215. I think he'd debate whether it would ever start again, but at a minimum, he's saying we don't even get there because we don't have that renewed judgment with a new filing stamp.
And I appreciate that. I think if the legislature had wanted to require a new judgment, they could have said, this is the process for getting a new judgment or a renewed judgment. Instead, they said this is the process to renew a judgment. And I think renewing a judgment is taking something old and making it new again, not creating something new. With regard to a lien without a right to collect, I don't believe a lien without a right to collect is a right at all. As such, I don't know why the legislature would have afforded a right that really affords nothing. If a party had a lien on my family's home with no right to execute or collect, I think I would sleep just fine at night. There must be a purpose of renewal. And the purposes I see for renewal would be execution, extension of the statutes of limitations regarding collections, regarding other actions. If there's no purpose to renewal, I don't know why anyone would renew a judgment. I think that's the whole point of renewal.
Now, it's not unusual for the court to issue an amended judgment. Is it your position that a renewal of a judgment, since it's not making any substantive changes to the relief awarded in the judgment itself, should be treated different than any other kind of amendment to a judgment? For example, let's say that judgment is amended to include attorney's fees. That would require a new judgment, wouldn't it?
I believe so. I think that's part of the judgment. But I don't think renewal is altering a judgment. It's just making it current again, and I think that's the distinction here. I think I've argued the points that I'd like to discuss. I'm happy to stand for any additional questions.
Did you want to make your attorney's fees argument?
There are a few grounds that V11 sought attorney's fees here in. The first would be under, and I think it's in the record, the guarantee states that in any action between Mr. Dean and D11's bank, that D11's is entitled to attorney's fees. I know I have some other arguments for attorney's fees in my briefing, and I don't have those in front of me. I would refer the court back to the briefing with any questions on those. Thank you.
Is your attorney's fees claim based solely on 12.120 Section 3?
Your Honor, I don't recall. I don't have that portion of my brief in front of me.
Let's assume it is. Could you make your argument why you think this qualifies as a type of commercial transaction to which you would be entitled?
Yes.
Because it would be no longer discretionary in that case.
Your Honor, the underlying case here certainly was a commercial transaction, the 2009 case. As I mentioned, as part of that 2009 case, Mr. Dean signed a commercial guarantee. Now, while that case has already been litigated and is not at issue here, that document was broader than just that case. It didn't state in any proceeding for collection of this specific note. It just stated in any proceeding between D11's bank, relating to this debt, if I recall the language correctly. This is the same debt, and as such, I believe D11's is entitled to attorney's fees.
And what about, was there a contractual basis based upon the commercial guarantee?
Right, and that's the document I'm referring to. That commercial guarantee is the contract between Mr. Dean and D11's bank, in which Mr. Dean agreed to pay attorney's fees incurred by D11's in attempting to collect on this now 13-year-old judgment debt.
Just curious, I noted that you did not make a request for attorney fees under 12.120. Parent 5, which is post-judgment collection of attorney fees. Is there a reason why?
I don't recall.
Does your failure to do so prohibit us from entering an award under that statutory provision?
I think the law is quite clear that in order to be awarded attorney's fees, you certainly need to have pled a specific rule entitling you to attorney's fees. I think that's clear.
Very well, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
10 minutes.
Thank you. Sir?
Thank you. I'll start off with the personal jurisdiction argument. The district court in this case found that the initial 12b-2 attack on personal jurisdiction was outside of the 14-day window afforded by 4.1b-7. That is the reason why the district court found it had personal jurisdiction in this case.
Well, hold on. It first found you failed to enter a special notice of appearance, right? And it cited Engelman.
Your Honor, I do not recall that being a basis. When I read that decision from the district court several times, I don't think the district court focused on that aspect of the, because that initial appearance by Mr. Brown did state that it was being made preserving defenses, including personal jurisdiction. I do not recall the district court hanging its hat on that appearance, so to speak.
And it may have been a different order, but I thought I did read the district court analyzing that initial notice of appearance and saying that statement, reserving all defenses, is not sufficient under Engelman. So could you speak to that issue and the Engelman case?
This is de novo review on a 12b2 motion. This court can look at what happened in the record. Those facts aren't disputed.
Well, and I'm talking about the sufficiency of the initial notice of appearance to preserve the defense of personal jurisdiction. Why, when I look at that notice of appearance, it submitted to jurisdiction of the court, personal jurisdiction, by failing to specifically reserve that defense, that's our holding in Engelman.
I believe that I have to admit that it did not, that appearance did not state it was a special appearance by Mr. Brown in this lawsuit. However, Mr. Brown did state that he was reserving defenses, including personal jurisdiction. I think in the spirit of the rule 1.1 of the civil rules are construed to do justice. If a party is the complaint on its face in this case stated that Mr. Dean was a resident of the state of Washington, I think most first-year law students would see the issue there. And Mr. Dean came in and challenged personal jurisdiction within 20 days of that appearance, and that appearance did notify the court that the defense of personal jurisdiction was being waived, or was not being waived, was being asserted. The issue I think the district court really dug into was the timeliness, about 14 days from an appearance. And I guess that's why I say the district court didn't hang its hat on the initial appearance, because the district court got into the timeliness of whether or not a 12b2 motion was made within the 14 days allowed by 4.1b7.
Why doesn't the court have personal jurisdiction over Mr. Dean?
The complaint in this case does not allege anything to do with Idaho's long-arm statute. Where the minimum contacts in this case, this new lawsuit, an action on a judgment that would drag Mr. Dean into Idaho and say that he has availed himself of the courts in Idaho.
Well, there's a judgment against him in Idaho.
I agree with that.
There's an effort to recover that judgment.
Would that mean that if I filed a lawsuit against a California entity here in Idaho and obtained a default judgment, I could file an action on judgment and say that California entity has availed itself of the courts of Idaho because I have a default judgment? I don't think that makes sense.
Well, one of the luxuries of being on this side of the bench is that we get to ask the questions, and one of the other luxuries is we get to say that I don't think the facts that you just suggested resemble the facts in this case.
Here we have a default judgment in 2010, and then an action on a judgment 10 years later in February 2020. I don't see the allegation of personal jurisdiction against Mr. Dean where he availed himself of the courts of Idaho. There's no allegation he was served in Idaho, no allegation he's living in Idaho.
There's a finding of fact that he had actual notice of the complaint.
In this case or the 2010
case? 2010 case.
Correct. And I'll jump there on the voidness argument momentarily. I don't believe...
You're not suggesting the court didn't have personal jurisdiction in 2010?
I haven't analyzed that thoroughly, Your Honor. I know he did contract.
He had actual notice.
Of the lawsuit in 2010?
Yes.
He did have
that? He had that in actual notice in 2009, because there's a representation that he made to D.O. Evans' lawyer that he was contesting it, or thought it shouldn't be pursued.
Correct. But again, that's a 2009 case number, and this is a 2020 case number. I think we have two different cases.
I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that he had actual notice in 2009. And had he acted in 2009, things would have been different.
I think that would be an argument regarding personal jurisdiction in the 2009 case. I don't think his actual notice of the 2009 lawsuit in 2009 establishes personal jurisdiction for a case filed in 2020.
Even though it's to recover on the case that was brought in 2009?
It's to recover on the debt represented by a judgment entered in 2009. And
so we somehow lost personal jurisdiction over him in the meantime?
I think that's represented by the fact that it's well established in the record in this case that D.L. Evans went to Washington to sue Mr. Dean there. I think D.L. Evans is aware of that issue.
And got no recourse, as I understand.
I don't think this is in the record. I don't know if the court wants me to comment on it.
I thought it was in a footnote in one of the briefs.
That lawsuit.
Nothing had happened in the Washington case.
That lawsuit is still underway, as I understand it.
And I think the concern, counsel, is that in the 2009 case, I don't think there's any dispute that Idaho's courts had jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction over Mr. Dean. He had made a guarantee on a loan. And he gets a default judgment entered against him. And then somehow Idaho's courts lose the ability to enforce that judgment against him when everything stems from the fact that he was doing business in the state of Idaho. I think that's the concern of your personal jurisdiction argument.
At some point, we need finality in relations between parties. That's why we have statute of limitations for, there's an entire chapter of Idaho Code that's as lengthy as any other section in the state that establishes statute of limitations. At some point, we need to resolve relations between people in our real world out there, and statute of limitations do that. I don't think a default judgment entered in 2010 can form the basis of personal jurisdiction in a lawsuit 10 years later.
Well, whose fault is that, though? I mean, it wasn't plaintiff's fault it was a default judgment. I'm sure they were happy to take it, but, I mean, the fact that the defendant refused to take any action to contest the debt they were seeking to collect is what resulted in the default judgment. I don't know how we can blame plaintiffs for winning by default. I'm sure they didn't care how they won. They just wanted to win.
I think that the answer to that question, Your Honor, is the fact that D.L. Evans knew it had personal jurisdiction issues or it wouldn't have gone to Washington to sue Mr. Dean where it knew that he resided.
I just worry if we provide a perverse incentive for people to get default judgments against them rather than contesting cases, because if you get a default judgment, it's not as worth as much as a regular adjudicated judgment.
I suppose I'm not focused on the personal jurisdiction issue in the 2009 case as much as where are the minimum contacts with the state of Idaho in the 2020 case to establish personal jurisdiction.
The judgment is located in Idaho. I'm trying to understand why, if you're going to bring an action on a judgment, to bring it in the state where the judgment is located originally. I mean, this isn't a foreign judgment that was registered in Idaho. This is an Idaho native judgment. Why wouldn't this be a place to have jurisdiction to bring an action on that judgment?
Because the Elevens had taken that judgment to Washington and attempted to domesticate it there and pursue collection proceedings against Mr. Dean in Washington.
That didn't cause it to evaporate in Idaho, though, did it? You can have a judgment in two different states at the same time.
The attempt to collect on the judgment in Washington is very different than renewing the native Idaho judgment. They're two very different proceedings. And to Justice Moeller's point, when you need to renew that judgment legally for it to remain effective in your collection efforts, wherever you undertake them, why would you renew it anywhere other than the state where it was entered or commence an action on it anywhere other than the state where it was entered?
Would you like my answer, Your Honor? I'm out of time.
You may answer, sir.
You would take the action to preserve your lien under the facts of our case. D.L. Evans would make its effort to renew its default judgment to preserve any lien rights in case Mr. Dean acquired property in Idaho. There was nothing preventing it in the five-year executable period of that default judgment from going to the state of Washington, trying to domesticate the judgment there and pursuing collection efforts against a known resident of the state of Washington. That is what the Elevens did, and I think that's how a judgment creditor must pursue what it is owed. Thank you.
Very well, sir. Thank you for your argument. Counsel, do you appreciate the time and effort in this case? The matter is under advice. We'll end the decision accordingly. We recess for approximately 10 minutes.
All rise, please.